All right, options traders, listen up. I want to tell you a bit about Public.com. But first, have you ever actually thought about all the fees you're paying to trade options? Aside from the regulatory fees, there are commissions, and most platforms charge per contract fees too. That's what makes today's sponsor, Public.com, so interesting. Public doesn't charge commissions or per contract fees. And in an industry first, they offer a rebate of up to 18 cents per option contract traded. Check it out. If you trade 1,000 option contracts on Public, you'll get up to $180 in rebates. If you trade 10,000 contracts, you could earn almost $2,000. More importantly, the rebate means you can maximize your profits and minimize your losses. To recap, no commissions, no per contract fees, and up to 18 cents on every contract traded. See why NerdWallet recently awarded Public 5 stars for option trading, and start earning up to 18 cents per contract traded, only at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing, options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description, US members only.
Welcome to The J-Row Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Row Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now, please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is the J-Row Show. Today, I'm launching a new segment of content for the show where I interview C-suite executives of publicly traded companies, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Ryan Pape. Ryan is the chairman, president, and CEO of XPEL. XPEL trades on the NASDAQ under the ticker XPEL. For disclosure purposes, I own stock in XPEL. But this is not a show about stocks. Rather, it's a show that dives into high-quality businesses and the management teams that run them. My objective is not to try to show you how smart I am or how much I know about a particular business. So my questions will be simple and straightforward, with the hope that these interviews help investors get up to speed on a business, the industry it operates in, and its management team in a relatively short period of time. These interviews are a jumping off point. It's up to the individual investor to continue their own research and to estimate the intrinsic value of the stock. Before I bring Ryan onto the show, I want to provide the audience with a very brief overview of the business and some key numbers to give you an intro into its size and operating history. XPEL offers an array of protective films and coatings for cars, homes, offices and commercial buildings, and marine crafts. It has a leading brand with leading market share, a healthy balance sheet, high historical growth rates, strong historical margins and returns on equity and returns on capital, and over 20% inside ownership according to S&P CapIQ. According to CapIQ, Ryan owns about $60 million worth of stock in XPEL. It's currently reinvesting all of its earnings into growth, so it doesn't generate a whole lot of free cash flow yet, and it doesn't pay a dividend or repurchase stock, but the diluted share count has remained flat at about 27.6 million diluted shares outstanding, so it's not growing through dilution. As I said, historically, it has grown quite rapidly and is profitable on a GAAP basis. Through year-end 2023, its five-year compounded annual growth rate for revenue is 25%, and its five-year EPS CAGR is 30%. Its trailing 12-month revenue is about $400 million. It has a market cap of about $1.6 billion and only $25 million in net debt, including leases, so its enterprise value is also about $1.6 billion. XPEL was founded in 1997 and is headquartered in San Antonio, Texas. Oh, and one last thing. Ryan became CEO on February 13th, 2009, when XPEL stock was about 4 pennies per share. Today's stock is about $59 per share. So listeners, I'll let you do the math on that one. Ryan, welcome to the J-Row Show.
Thank you, John. Yeah, great to be here. Great intro.
Let's dive right in. Ryan, What is Expel? What products or services do you sell?
Yeah, John, you covered it well in the intro. We are a leading provider of films and coatings. And I think for most people, most consumers, and probably some of your listeners, we're best known for paint protection film. And this is really a category of product that I would say we helped invent, even though we weren't the very first product in existence. And paint protection film is an invisible TPU-based film that goes on the front of vehicles or up to an entire vehicle to protect it from rock chips and other damage.
Awesome. What is your business model and who are you selling your products to? Who are your customers?
So if you look at our end customer is in the automotive space, anyone that owns a car. If you look at where we actually generate our revenue, this isn't a do-it-yourself product. This is a professionally installed set of products. So we're not selling these products to the end consumer. We're selling them into the channel that's then responsible for selling and installing them to end consumers. So a big part of our business, the majority actually, is to what we would call the automotive aftermarket. These are typically smaller mom-and-pop shops around the world that would carry our products and install them for consumers in their local market. And the second largest customer type would be new car dealerships, franchise dealerships. And as you can imagine, when you're selling a protective film for a new car, principally, that's when you really want to protect it. You know, a new car dealership is a great place to sell the product.
Definitely. So what problem is Expel solving for the end user? And then what problem is Expel solving for the installers and your dealership partners?
Sure. So if you look at our two largest product sets by revenue, paint protection film, the problem we're solving there is a pretty simple one to understand, which is damage to paint. And anyone that's bought a new car knows that typically within a short period of time, leaving the lot with a brand new car, you're going to experience damage to the paint in one way or the other, typically rock chips from driving down the road. Historically, when you look at the customer satisfaction surveys for new car buyers, damage to the paint, rock chips, however you want to stylize it, has been the top, if not a top, complaint from the new car buyer. Second product, really, in terms of the auto buyer, would be our window tint products. Obviously, there you're trying to reduce heat, glare, sun. I think probably more people familiar with sort of the why on the window tint side of the business.
Sure.
When you're to the second part of your question, when you're looking at the channel that we sell to, both the aftermarket or the independent installers or the dealership, you know, their primary reason in both of those channels to sell the products is a profit motive. You know, it's a good business for them to be in to sell and install the products to the end customer.
Excellent. So reading through some of your materials, it looks like 85% of revenue is product and 15% is services. What are the margins on the product versus the services revenue? And maybe what is the average growth rate of each line of business? Rough ballparks here is perfectly fine. And I'm just trying to get to, is one line of business growing faster than the other? And do you think that breakdown of roughly 85% product and 15% services will kind of remain for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, so all good questions. I think if you look at the overall gross margin profile for us, the service business has historically had a higher gross margin and the product business the lower gross margin. Now, what's been happening over time is the product gross margin's actually been increasing, and you can kind of see that reflected in our aggregate gross margin increases that we've had over a period of years. And that's really due to product mix, geography mix, and then work we've done to actually increase the gross margin of some of our products. Mm-hmm. And then the service gross margins actually probably declined. And that's because our original service business that we had was all software, which I know we'll talk about. Then we added some installation of the product that was more retail focused, actually in a few locations we have around the world where we actually install the product for end consumers. But then the service business really has pivoted more towards wholesale work, where we're doing work for dealerships, we're doing work for some car manufacturers, and that actually has reduced the aggregate service gross margin. So you really have a trend where product gross margin's been going up, service gross margin was higher and is going down nominally, and then at some point in the future, we think the two gross margin profiles probably cross at a higher aggregate gross margin than where we are today, more than likely. But how that happens probably depends on the second part of your question, which is, you know, what do we see the percent of total revenue service versus product, yep, and which do we see growing faster? And I think, you know, our mandate is we want more products on more cars, more of our products on more cars. And, you know, our strategy and how we do that needs to be flexible in order to accommodate that. So we're not prioritizing a service where we might install the product over product where someone else does it. But we're also willing to be in the service business to help that goal of more product on more cars if there aren't service providers or our customers or our broader network is either, you know, unable or unwilling or not present somewhere to do the work. So probably it grows faster, mainly because it's a smaller part of the overall business.
Sure.
But to say that mix radically changes, you know, a few years out, it probably doesn't in terms of the overall. It probably grows nominally as a percent of revenue.
Ryan, I really like that simple sort of North Star or mandate that y'all have of more products on more cars. It's just really clear and simple to understand. So I appreciate you sharing that. So you mentioned the software business, sort of your original business historically. Talk to us about that business a little bit. As I understand it, you have a proprietary software that has a library of car makes, models, and dimensions so that films can be cut to exact sizes to make it more efficient to install with less waste. Do you sell the software separately? And do the software sales flow through that 15% of service revenue? And how many car makes and models do you have in your software platform to aid installers in cutting the film to the exact car dimensions?
Sure. Yeah, no, you're exactly right. The reason that we have and originally had this software is exactly for what you said, where in the software is a library of patterns, and the patterns are used to cut the films and aid in the installation of them. And so when we actually sell the products, we're selling rolls of film. You know, if you imagine a large, you know, heavy roll that we're sending to a customer, and then using the software and a cutting machine, which the cutting machine is sort of a commodity machine, you can cut out of the film the pieces you need for whatever window or panel you're applying the film on. And then at that point, they're really peeled off like a large sticker to begin the installation process. Mm-hmm. And this is huge for a couple reasons. One, if you're not doing it that way, the alternative is to sort of roll the film on the car and cut it with a sharp knife and hope that you're cutting through the film, but not through the film into the paint.
Yep.
And so for a product in terms of paint protection film that you're trying to have to protect the finish of a new car, you know, that's a tough way to sort of start the installation process. And then the second point really is that it's just faster. If you can have patterns that match the properties of the film, that match how you have trained installers, and you design all of that in one system, you know, you can cut substantial labor time from the installation. And, you know, in most places, labor is going to be the number one component of the cost of goods of the final installed product. It's not actually the material.
Mm-hmm. Anything else we should know about the software business?
Well, that's where we started. The business was originally going to be a software business, which is a little bit of a chuckle now when you look at what the business has become. So we have that in our roots, but it was really more than software. It was really a pattern business, if you will, because the pattern was really the important part and still is. And to your other question, I mean, we have patterns for pretty much every make and model of every car sold almost everywhere in the world. And, you know, that could be from the leading edge of the car, the leading panels of the car, up to and including the full car, depending on the vehicle and the end market. I think for us, the software business today is really an enabler of the rest of the business. And so it's not a product that we sell separately. It's really there to support our XPEL authorized dealers and dealerships. Because it's designed to work specifically with our films and products as well. But that said, over the past year, we really started a process to say, let's make the software valuable as software rather than just as a conduit to the patterns. And that's really providing our customers sort of the sales and sales enablement, marketing, and ERP tools that we think will help them scale their businesses and run a better business. So, you know, even though that's been part of our business and a part of the revenue for a long time, I would say, you know, now in 2024 is really the first time we're really beginning and in the early stages of approaching that part of the business as a true software business, if you will.
That's interesting. And is this, would you consider the patterns that you have in your library a big selling point to get installers and dealerships on board?
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you look at the efficiency that can be generated by doing the patterns in the right way, and like I alluded to, you know, there's more to it than just, you know, having a pattern. I think probably the work to acquire that pattern is more complicated than people think. And you really want it to match, like I said, the properties of the film, but then also how you've been trained to install. And doing training of technicians is a big part of our business and hopefully a big value proposition to our customers. It's not really a moneymaker for us. But when you put all that together, you can create a system that is very efficient and can save money and save time. And then the other part I would add is that if you're not willing to cut the film on the car, which we don't recommend, obviously, then having a pattern and having it timely is a prerequisite to even make the sale. So if you don't have it or you don't have it in the right place at the right time, you know, that's potentially a sale loss for us and our customers downstream in the market.
Yeah, definitely. So auto is your biggest end market. So how much does your, let's just say, you know, your best-selling auto film cost to the end user? Maybe how much does it cost on average to coat the whole car? And then maybe how much does it cost on average to coat maybe just the front portion of the car?
Sure. Well, and I think you've alluded to one of the benefits of this product for us, for our customers, and for the end consumers, which is that, you know, it can be by nature of how it's cut on demand and installed on demand, it can be scaled from a small amount of coverage to literally the entire car. So, you know, it's not uncommon to see in a dealership setting a very small amount of paint protection film, maybe sold with window tint to the end customer for a package that's, you know, $400 or even less in some cases. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, you'll see full cars where you're doing every painted panel of the car, you know, 7,000-8,000 plus just for paint protection film. So those are obviously two really extreme examples. You know, if you, and it's tough to talk about pricing because you've got so many different markets and geographies and labor rates and things like that. But if you look at sort of the sweet spot for the business in the aftermarket, which is the largest part of the business, that's really probably what we would call full front protection, which is everything in front of the windshield, you know, the full hood, fenders, bumper. That would be most common now, targeting sort of that enthusiast buyer in the aftermarket. And you'll see a range of price points for that, depending on where you are, but, you know, $2,000, $2,500 range, that's pretty common.
I mean, that's still, you know, $2,500 on a $40,000 car. I'm just doing math. That's only like 6% of the price of the car. So you're getting a
I would tell you too, if you look at the environment that we've been in, you know, in terms of car prices over the past several years, you know, the products have probably become more cost effective relative to the overall sales price of the car. So yeah, you haven't seen sort of the installed cost of the products grow at the same rate you've seen new car prices increase.
Yeah, very, and that's what I was getting at. Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. So your 10K says that some of your films have quote unquote self-healing properties. So my question is, are your films proprietary in any way? Is this self-healing technology proprietary? Are your films different, you know, highly differentiated or unique from other products in the market? And if so, what makes them unique? How unique are they?
Yeah, I think you really, when you look at that, you have two audiences to consider. So in terms of the consumer, we've got, you know, best in class products for the things that the consumer cares about. And, you know, the self-healing is one of them. You know, a funny story on that, that what emerged as the first self-healing film from us years ago was really a byproduct of making the first film that had really good outdoor weatherability. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, the self-healing has a sort of consumer and marketing buzz, but initially it was even a byproduct of making something that truly could withstand the elements in a harsh environment. You imagine the heat, sun, cold, rain, snow for 10 years. And so that's where that came from. But these products are best in class. You know that you can see that in the data when you look at the repeat buyers. You know, it is so common that once you've bought the product that you come back and buy it again because it does what it's supposed to do in terms of protecting the finish and protecting the paint. And then the product itself holds up exceptionally well. When you talk about the other half of the audience, though, which is really the installer, because, you know, there's a push-pull strategy in terms of why your products are purchased by the end customer. In some cases, they're asking for them by name, which for us, thankfully, happens a lot as Expel. But on the other hand, they're being recommended by, you know, a trusted local service provider. And so there's additional properties and characteristics that the professional cares about that the end consumer doesn't. Things around the installation properties and the intersection of the properties of the film versus the training you've been given, maybe versus the patterns that you're using to install it. So, you know, in addition to having the best in class, you know, end product for the consumer, you've got all these other things to consider from the professional standpoint that I think are probably less obvious, but equally important for a lot of people.
Excellent. So I've read that Expel has about 40% share of the automotive market in the U.S. Is that number roughly accurate? If not, what is your market share in the U.S.? And yeah. Sorry, just what are your market share trends? Are you gaining share, losing share, holding steady?
Yeah, over time, we've gained share. Taking share is a part of the growth, but I think at this point, you know, what we're focused on is trying to grow awareness and grow the set of customers actually buying the product. I mean, everybody likes to take share, but I think in most businesses, you know, there's maybe too much focus on taking share and not enough focus on growing the market. So we're very much focused on that. In terms of U.S. market share for paint protection film, you know, those are sort of the numbers that we have, you know, 35-40%. You know, I think there's low confidence on those. There's not a lot of folks studying that in, right, in an absolute sense. But we have seen that grow over time. And, you know, we're really focused now also on let's grow market share where we can. But how do we make the market even bigger? And how do we make the market grow beyond the traditional enthusiast buyer that, you know, is a large portion of our customer base and ultimately our competitors' customer base as well?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point just to highlight. You're not only focused on growing market share, but also on growing the size of the market. Is the industry rational when it comes to pricing?
I think the industry is rational when it comes to pricing. You know, one of the kind of related questions and questions we've had over time is sort of, well, you know, why doesn't XPEL just spend more money on marketing or more money on this or more money on that to grow faster? You know, if you look at our historic growth. And well, part of the reason that we wouldn't do that, I think the question for us, maybe even on a more historical basis, is, well, would you spend even more on marketing, even at the expense of your profitability in the early days, to grow faster? It's maybe a better way to say the question.
Sure.
And I think the answer was no, because, you know, if you look at what has to happen with our products to ultimately sell them, you know, they have to be installed by a technician. And, you know, you mentioned it earlier, maybe 15% of the time or something, you know, that could be us, but the vast majority of the time it's not. And it's someone else that has to recruit, train in many cases, more technicians to grow their business. So there is a limit in terms of the sort of instantaneous scalability of the business that's really limited by the capacity that the industry has, the technician capacity to do this work. And so that has sort of guided some of our decisions and probably others too. But I think it also makes the business and the competitive set and the pricing work rationally, I would say.
I like that. What is XPEL's pricing strategy historically? Maybe how often do you increase prices, and by how much are you increasing prices annually? And maybe what, when you do increase prices, what is the average price increase?
Well, our strategy overall has historically been to be priced as the premium provider that we are. I would much rather, and our team would much rather, find ways to provide you extra value, which could be the things we talked about, could be our marketing, could be in all of these different areas we could do that, rather than win business by competing on price. So I think if you look across the product lines, across geographies, I mean, for us to be 10, 15%, a higher price than the competitive set, or even the next best competitor in some cases, you know, that's kind of where we've wanted to be, and where we have been. So, you know, with that, I think our overall pricing cadence in terms of price increases over time, you know, we've probably averaged some type of price increase more on a year and a half to 2 year timeline cadence over time. Mm-hmm. And they've tended to be pretty modest. I mean, 1.5% to 2%, maybe a little bit higher in some regions at some times. But, you know, ideally we're, again, driving forward by providing value and doing that in a way that our customers and our existing customers can grow.
Definitely. Ryan, your balance sheet seems quite healthy, very strong, with little debt and an interest coverage ratio, which I'm defining as EBIT to interest expense of, you know, 50 times. But can you briefly talk about why you have the small amount of debt you have, what you use it for, and why you chose to use some variable debt?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the balance sheet over a period of many years, you know, the debt's been very low. I mean, probably net debt zero the majority of the quarters.
Definitely.
You know, up to the present. I mean, I think you know, there's an argument on one hand that it's too low, right? That a turn or a turn and a half of debt to EBITDA might be even a better structure. Obviously, it was better when that debt was cheaper, you know, mm-hmm. 2 years ago or whatever. But I think that, you know, the view of how we've used the debt has been principally to fund small acquisitions. And then we've eliminated that debt from cash from operations in pretty short order. So I think the sort of the variable debt piece has probably worked well for us in that. If we were doing larger acquisitions or, you know, doing something different, we would probably look potentially to a different structure to do that if we didn't think it could be done that way.
Yeah, that's one thing I've really admired about how you've managed the balance sheet and the cash flows is taking on a small debt and then that cadence of paying it down pretty quickly with internally generated cash flows. What are one or two of your largest costs on the income statement? And are you subject to a lot of input cost inflation?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the largest cost is going to be your material cost of goods. We've been in an interesting environment over the past 3 years in terms of input costs. I think we've seen it, as have others, and then also input availability. Looking at some of the feedstock into some of the resin, into the raw materials that we might buy, force majeure for periods of time. So it's been very disruptive. You see it in our overall balance sheet where our inventory has grown substantially. We did that sort of knowingly, seeing a lot of this disruption and the risk of a stock out or something, 2 years ago. And so we've been in the process of really trying to unwind that now. But aside from sort of the elements of cost of goods, our people are our greatest asset and our greatest expense. Marketing is really important, and one that we've been working to increase, obviously in an aggregate number, but also on a percent of sales basis is something that we want to increase. And I think, if you look at our desire to grow the addressable market of who knows about these products and buys them beyond sort of the core of the enthusiast buyer, then that's an important investment to make.
Earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. Paid for by Public Investing, options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description, U.S. members only. FinChat.io is the complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. They have all the standard financial data on more than 100,000 stocks globally. But beyond that, they have company-specific segment and KPI data on more than 1,500 stocks. Want to see Netflix's average revenue per member over the last 10 years? FinChat's got it. Like to track YouTube's advertising? They've got that too. Want to see how much of Celsius's revenue comes from Costco? You guessed it, they've got it. Want to see Home Depot's average ticket price or sales per square foot? FinChat's gotcha covered. The breadth of FinChat's segment and KPI data is truly one of a kind. I use FinChat and love it for the KPIs I can't easily find anywhere else, the awesome screener, and the quick and easy charting tool. To get 15% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/JRO. That is finchat.io/JRO to get 15% off any paid plan today. The link will be in the show notes. So we talked about the balance sheet quickly. We talked about some of the expenses on the income statement. I'd like to ask you some questions now about where your future growth will come from. So maybe to start, what percentage of new cars in the U.S. currently have protective films? And what percentage of new cars have these films outside of the U.S.?
Yeah, so there's this sort of generally accepted number that maybe 8% plus or minus of new cars in the U.S. have some type of paint protection film on it. Again, I think low confidence number, but that's sort of around where everyone has settled. The challenge there, though, is really back to the previous question, which is, well, some amount of attachment is great, but that could be a little, could be a small leading edge strip, or could be door edges or door cups, or it could be the full car. So, that attachment rate versus average content per car are probably two very different things. And we've seen over time, the average content per car has increased quite a bit over a longer period of time. You know, outside the U.S., if you look at Europe, particularly South America, you know, the penetration rates are unquestionably substantially lower. And mainly because these markets like those, they just haven't been developed. I mean, you look at sort of why. Well, if you've got to build a technician and installer base, and you've got to build consumer awareness or dealership awareness or all of the above to grow, you know, there's sort of a process that has to play out in terms of the time and market, right? How long has the product been sold? And as people buy it and they buy it again, as there's, you know, a few points of installation, and then there are more points of installation, as there are a few technicians and now there are more, you know, you see how the attach rates or penetration rates can then follow. And some of that you can sort of force, and some of that is a process that just plays out over time.
Very clear. So are the main drivers of growth inside the US, just growing that market, more marketing, more end user awareness? Is that the strategy to grow inside the US
I think when you look at the market, at least our view of the market of the buyer is, you know, 15% of the new car buyer are enthusiasts. And in our view, you know, these are people that get part of their identity from their car, right? Sure. That's a heavy lift. 25% of the new car buyer doesn't care at all and will never buy our products. And they're out. You know, they have no pride of ownership, of owning the car at all. But then you're left with this, you know, 50, 60% in the middle who they do have pride of ownership. They don't get their identity from their car, but they do have pride of ownership. It's an expensive purchase. They want to keep it in good shape. They don't like that it's damaged as soon as they drive it off the lot. They have pride of ownership. Well, the sales today and the industry that we're in, it's really dominated in that 15% of the enthusiasts. I mean, however you want to slice and dice it, it's the majority of the sales today. So where the largest opportunity to grow is within that middle 50, 60%. And to reach those, you know, they're not enthusiasts. They're not going to learn about the product on their own through, you know, internet forums or car clubs or whatever they might participate in, because they're not that person. So to reach that middle chunk, you've got to have dealerships involved in selling the product. You could have manufacturers or OEMs involved in selling it. And then it probably also takes us and the industry to really start to market to people that aren't already looking for paint protection film, but to marketing to people who are buying or have bought a new car that this product is available. So I think big picture, that's where in a market like the US, where the greatest amount of growth is going to come from.
Very clear. Thank you for that. Is there any macro level metric that is a big driver of sales, maybe new car sales, maybe something else? What I'm trying to get at is some businesses, largely, honestly, probably slower growing businesses than your own, but some businesses grow at an industry level plus some additional percentage for market share gains or acquisitions. And I'm just trying to figure out if there's a big macro driver of your growth that investors can follow, or maybe if you have any industry level data on how fast the automotive film industry is expected to grow over the next few years, anything like that you can share with us?
Yeah, I don't think there's any industry level data that we found particularly compelling or useful. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately at a more mature state of the overall market, including that middle 50% we talked about, I mean, you would become SAR bound, you know, new car SAR bound at some point, because it is, the paint protection film is a new car product. But today, I don't think you necessarily are that correlated. You know, we saw when over the past, you know, 3 years, when the SAR was down due to inventory, our sales were up because the attachment rate is growing and you have other dynamics going on. So I don't think we found the real macro level there, lever there. It's probably ultimately more tied to car sales, you know, sort of future state, if it can reach more maturity.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes total sense. So XPEL is a brand and business that has scaled well around the world, with 43% of sales generated outside of the U.S. We talked about it a little earlier, but is growing outside of the U.S. still a big growth driver and growth potential for XPEL?
Yeah, the international opportunity is still huge. And you know, as we mentioned earlier, in many places in its infancy, even relative to the U.S., mm-hmm. you know, we've always focused intentionally on the international market, particularly earlier in our life. You know, we would get asked frequently, why go worry about what's happening in country XYZ when the U.S. still has so much opportunity in it? And my answer was really twofold, is that, you know, one, there's only one chance in life probably to be the global brand for this product. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to cut off big chunks in the world, you're going to preclude yourself from being that. So, you know, having that presence was super important, and it pays dividends now as we're looking to grow these other markets that are, you know, many years behind the U.S., which is, you know, something that's really important. And the second was, you know, a realization that, you know, your products and your brand is going to be present all over the world, whether you want it to be or not. And you can either be there doing your best to control it, regulate it, and grow it, or, you know, the world of gray market exports and counterfeiting will do it for you. And so it was for both of those reasons why, from a really early time, we've always had this heavy international focus. I mean, now, like you said, if it's 43% of sales, but for many years it was well over 50. So still continues to be a big focus of ours. It was one of our uses of capital from M&A, where we've acquired distributors in other countries. And that's really to be present, to be able to invest in the market, to actually grow it and, you know, bring some order to it and be hopefully a high value provider to our customers there.
Yeah, Ryan, I love that. So, you know, so far talking to you today, we've already kind of learned two long-term goals. One is more products on more cars, and the other one is to be the biggest global brand in the protective film space. And so those have been two of your sort of, you know, goals or mandates under your leadership at the company. So
yes.
I'm going to get into some more accounting questions, but because we just talked about, you know, two of your mandates, two of your goals, as CEO, can you just tell us more briefly about your story? I opened up saying that when you became CEO in February of 2009, you know, you were in your 30s, I think. I think now you're in your kind of low 40s, and the stock price was 4 pennies a share. So can you just tell us a little bit about becoming CEO and give us a brief history of XPEL since you became CEO?
Sure. Well, I think in many ways I was the accidental CEO. I was going to have a career in tech and in software. That was my degree. And I ended up working for a company that was doing consulting work for XPEL when it was very small and when it was going to be a software company. And after some period of time, I joined the company really in the same capacity to build the software that was the business. And it took, you know, many iterations and a lot of pain, but the business eventually changed to say, well, you can't be a business about the software where the software is solely there to support a product, where the product doesn't exist, the brand doesn't exist, the end market demand doesn't exist. The labor doesn't exist. You know, it was a good solution to a product that didn't exist. And so, after a period of time, there were different, you know, management changes at Expel. I ended up leaving the company. And then in 2009, was asked if I wanted to return to be the CEO. And I joke, but it's not really a joke because I think it's true. I joke that they asked me because there was no one else left. There was no one else to do it. And the company was in terrible financial shape. And I think negative working capital and sort of just dribbling out dollars every day to vendors to sort of stay alive. But I knew at that time that there was a business and there was a product here, or there was a business to be built around the product. And I never had a question about that. You know, I think there were probably many points since then that the business exceeded what I thought it would do at that time, but that's probably no surprise. I mean, there wasn't a Harvard Business Review case study of what we were doing at the time. It was just a good idea that just needed to be better run and kept alive until it could reach some critical mass. So I became the CEO in 2009. We had probably 2 years of really just trying to stay alive. We sold off part of the company to raise some cash to fulfill some obligations, and, you know, did that for another year. And then, you know, about 3 years in, we started to get some traction, started to build a real business, and started to actually grow revenue and work to become the company that we are today.
Incredible story. Ryan, do you know, is there a Harvard case study today? I know you said there
wasn't. No, there wasn't then, and there isn't now. So.
Well, I mean, there should, in all seriousness, maybe there should be, because it sounds easy now, but the realization that you had when you were the consultant, the software consultant at the time, was there's this great software for a product that doesn't exist yet. And so seeing, and, you know, in a market that doesn't exist yet, and a brand that doesn't exist yet. And so seeing the need to shift the business model and strategy completely to building the market for the software, I think that's a pretty big realization that a case study could surely be written about. And then when you look at the turnaround in the financials and then the stock price, I mean, it's a $59 or $60 stock today. So, you know, incredible return. So thank you for sharing that story.
I think it's, you know, it's interesting, right? Because there's lessons in it for everybody, because, you know, I was in my 20s, and then I think 28 or something when I became the CEO. And, you know, prior to that, it says, well, I saw where elements of the strategy didn't work, but then you say, well, you know, what do I know? Is that me, or the other people have it figured out? Am I the outlier? Or am I the guy with the good idea? Like, how do you know? Right. So there's something to be said for the persistence aspect. And then ultimately, you know, being put in a situation where you can do something about it. And then, you know, if those 3 years were any guide, just having the grit to push through and do it. And I see that now when you look at our business in our customers in the aftermarket, who are, you know, running their own businesses. They may have 2 to 10 employees, some more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of them are incredibly successful just by sort of that grit and just pushing through, you know. And if someone smarter than them or someone smarter than me had sat down and really studied the problem extensively on the front end, you know, would they have agreed to even do it? So there's a kind of interesting leadership phenomenon on, you know, are we sometimes too smart where we might convince ourselves against doing anything versus, you know, just jumping in and pushing through. And I think, you know, there's some of that in our story for sure.
There for sure is. And I think there's a whole nother podcast that we could do on where you got that grit from. And so maybe we'll do that another time. But I love the story and the history behind this company, and your role there so much. And it's one of the things that attracted me to the company. I'm a numbers guy though, and so I'm gonna go back to some accounting questions. So XBELL has generated strong and consistent increases in gross margin, EBIT margin, and net income margins. You mentioned a little bit earlier, but what are the drivers of this margin increase? And do you think over time, over long periods of time, that's sustainable? Or do you think we've kind of reached normalized margins maybe?
Yeah, so if you look at the gross margin performance, and really the rest of the income statement really drives from that, truly, in our case. When you look at gross margin overall, you've got a number of things that have played out over a period of time. One is the product mix, and by that I mean product and service mix, where we've added more products, we've added products within existing product lines, and we've added service revenue. And the combination of all of those has been a trend towards a higher gross margin. So that truly that product mix by itself, but the products and service mix has given us a higher gross margin trend. We talked a little bit about the international business and our desire to be present internationally with our own operations. That adds gross margin for sure. So sort of from a channel standpoint, it does it in kind of an obvious way, which is if we acquire a distributor of ours in another country, well, we're giving that distributor margin to then resell to the customers in country. And if you buy them, then you get to put the two halves of the gross margin piece together. But the part that's maybe less well understood with that is that after doing that, we tended to grow sales in those countries faster than they were growing before. So you get both halves of the gross margin and then grow faster. So the channel mix, geography mix has been a driver of that gross margin increase as well. And then the last piece is really on the product and on cost of goods. You know, we've been successful at actually over time removing some costs from our products, even in the face of other higher input costs. So we've had a accretive gross margin truly from some of the product costs as well. So it's really the three of those things that have driven that. And you know, looking forward, there's opportunity within all three of those segments to go. So we haven't hit, you know, sort of a ceiling yet on what we think the blended gross margin profile of the business could be. We believe it's higher. Now, there's a lot of things embedded in that that we don't control, nor do we want to control directly, which is, you know, we're never going to decline revenue in a lower gross margin geography just to have a higher overall gross margin. I know it sounds silly to say, but we wouldn't do that. And then, you know, product versus service, product lines versus another product line, you know, we want to sell it all. So to some extent, you know, the trajectory of that gross margin and the split there will happen to us. But I think those three pillars kind of give us the ability to grow gross margin over time from where we are.
Awesome, Ryan. So at the same time that margins are increasing, asset turnover is falling, inventory turnover is falling, and days of inventory and the cash conversion cycle are rising. You mentioned, you know, you increased inventory during some of the supply chain disruptions, but I just want to dive back into that. So, is that what is driving the decline in asset turnover and inventory turnover? And is that driving the dramatic rise in the cash conversion cycle? Is it just building up this inventory during the supply chain disruptions?
Yeah, I think if you look at sort of, you know, what are the what are the macro trends in the business over a multi-year period that could impact all of those numbers you just mentioned? Mm-hmm. There's probably two, but there's only one that really matters. And that's the growth in inventory.
Yeah.
And the second being kind of as our customer profile evolves, probably on the balance, more growth to a customer profile that gets more extended terms or gets payment terms at all. If you're selling to car dealerships, for example, you're probably getting paid in 60 days plus. If you're selling to the aftermarket, you're probably getting paid on a credit card. But that's really relatively minor to the first point, which is the inventory. You know, I think that when the COVID shutdowns happened, you know, everybody, ourselves included, even those who didn't think you had a dependence in China at the time from your supply chain, realized ways that you do, right? If the supplier of a supplier of a supplier needed something from China to ultimately make part of the product or some input or component that you bought that you didn't know about. And so the first step was really coming out of that, recognizing there is more risk on a permanent basis to the supply chain than we probably imagined there was prior. So that was kind of a step up in days on hand of inventory.
Sure.
But then after that, you ran into more acute shortages. There was a force majeure H12 MDI at one point. It was going to impact the resins that you need to make the TPU to make the film. And there were probably that and, you know, another thing or two that caused us to be as conservative as possible in terms of inventory planning. Because when you're selling to customers in the aftermarket like we are, you know, we're shipping product today that they need tomorrow or that they need the next day.
Yep.
So not having inventory, even on short periods of time, causes huge operational stress. So we, you know, were as conservative as possible. You've seen tremendous cash put into inventory. We really intended to even reduce those days on hand more last year, 2023. You know, a couple other wrinkles sort of prevented us from doing that. But that's really a big focus for this year, is to get that days on hand down. It won't be what it was pre-COVID. I think mm-hmm. that's safe to say. But it'll be you know, substantially lower on a days on hand basis as we get towards the end of this year. And then I think the rest of those numbers that you mentioned start to look a lot better.
They definitely do. Yes. As a quick follow-up, Expel's cash flow from operations is often less than net income, specifically because of growth of inventories from one year to the next. Is that, in your view, the main reason the cash flow from operations is sometimes less than net income, that inventory line again, the change in inventories?
Yeah, if you look at it over the past 3 years, I mean, that's really what's driving that. I mean, we expect that, you know, inventory will grow over time. Inventory will grow with revenue, probably lower than revenue, but will continue to grow. The other elements of working capital will probably do the same. But the reason you've seen that delta is the growth in days on hand over that period of time.
Awesome. Yeah, that's what I thought. So Expel has a very asset-light business model with a five-year average CapEx to sales of about 2%. Just curious why you chose the asset-light model, because on the one hand, it's obviously less capital-intensive, which I think is one factor driving your very high returns on equity and capital. On the other hand, you're not manufacturing in-house, and so possibly somewhat opening yourself up to quality control issues, and also possibly giving up the opportunity to drive high sales volume through your own factories to achieve fixed cost operating leverage. So in other words, just why choose the variable business model over a more fixed cost business model? And do you think there is any benefit to vertically integrating to some degree down the road?
Yeah, so great question. I think that, you know, when you look at where we started, the asset light model was the only option, right? Because there right. just there was no other choice. But what we realized was that even as we grew and we were profitable and we had cash to invest, that allowed us to focus on the brand and focus on the channel at a time when really no one else was doing that.
Sure.
And so that quickly went from something that we had no control over to something that we decided to do affirmatively. And then as you grow over time, as we have, you know, the options of what you do expand because, you know, there is the ability theoretically to have your cake and eat it too. I think to your question on quality, you know, we have a large quality team, and in many respects, they're doing the same type of work externally that they would be doing internally. So, you know, if you have good, you know, manufacturing and you have a disciplined quality process, you're not necessarily at a quality disadvantage just because you can't turn the wrench yourself, so to speak.
Makes sense.
But it requires a commitment to that quality function, which, you know, again, at some point in time in our history, we didn't have, but we certainly do now. I think, you know, the other thing that allowed us to do, and you see this with other manufacturers that emerged over time, is, you know, when you're not focused on overcoming your fixed costs, mm-hmm. You can make different decisions about how you go to market. When you are focused on that, all of a sudden, you know, you need to keep the wheels turning. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, does it mean you have a lot of excess capacity and your business model needs to change to start being a low cost, high volume provider, you know, which is something that we never wanted to be.
Sure.
So I think that worked to our advantage and to be who we are. Now at the place we are now, though, you have different options, and you know, you can pursue more vertical integration in parts of the supply chain while doing the other things, and you have a large existing volume that, you know, you could allocate differently versus trying to find volume to fill up some sort of manufacturing investment. So that does change the math for us going forward. I think that we weigh all of those decisions against other opportunities to allocate capital, and then against, you know, management time and other resources. But, you know, your options at the size we are now are much different than they were before. And so, you know, we're certainly open to pursuing more vertical integration as we go forward.
I love that. Love to hear how you you and your team thought through that and how that changed over time as you scaled and got bigger and stronger. So sticking with the cash flow statement briefly, you do spend some money on acquisitions every year. What are you buying?
So if you look at probably what we bought the most of in terms of number of acquisitions and where we get the highest returns, it's been to acquire our distributors in countries in which we want to operate, mm-hmm. For the reasons that we mentioned earlier. That said, you know, the number of those is sort of relatively few and far between, right? And I would say, you know, we have a short list of countries that we'd like to operate in directly that we're not currently in, but that probably doesn't put, we'll probably do that, but it probably doesn't put a whole lot of capital to work. Beyond sort of that distribution, you know, we've gone downstream looking at deeper in the channel in terms of the installation and service and installation of the products and service. And really that's been with an eye towards the dealership business. And how do you get more product penetration into dealerships and OEM secondarily to help with that 50-60% of the market that's a good channel to access.
Yeah.
That's probably where we've spent the most money and have the opportunity to continue to do so. You know, doing high volume work in a dealership environment isn't something that every customer of ours in the aftermarket wants to do. Those that do, we have a whole series of things that we are doing and that we plan to do to support them. But at some point, we'll make investments to do that dealership work internally as well. And then, you know, the third is really, if you look at adjacent products or services that might make sense for us as we grow as a business, that would really be the third. And obviously, that's a very broad category of things and one that needs sort of incredible discipline so that we don't try to become all things to all people. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, you put those three together and we think that, you know, we should be able to reinvest the cash flow we generate, even normalized for a normal inventory situation, et cetera, that we should easily be able to reinvest that into growing the business over time.
Have you shared how many acquisitions the company has made and what multiples you're paying for these acquisitions, whether of EBITDA or earnings or free cash flow, and like what IRRs you hope to earn on these acquisitions?
Yeah, I think, I mean, over time, I don't know, we've probably done 30 or more small acquisitions. If you go back a number of years, just kind of thinking off the top of my head, you know, our focus has really been around EBITDA multiples, as you mentioned. I think kind of the IRR drives from that really depends a lot on, are there other product synergies or other things we get from that? Sometimes we bought things and you actually have initially negative synergies because we're, you know, upgrading what they're doing, but obviously looking at growth after that. For us, I mean, most of what we've acquired has been around 3 to 5x EBITDA multiples. Probably done something a little bit higher, but that's been sort of the sweet spot where a lot of these lists, 3 to 5, maybe done a 6x plus a time or two.
I mean, you can understand, you know, why you're able to generate such high returns when you have this opportunity to deploy capital at 3 to 5 or 6 times EBITDA. And, you know, it's not many CEOs that will talk about negative synergies, but I appreciate the transparency. Sometimes there's so much work that has to be done that you start off with negative synergies before you can
get them. Yeah. Yeah. And that's a challenge of small acquisitions, right? Is that, you know, just going in and upgrading some system or bringing it to our standards or bringing employee benefits to a certain level or putting in our IT or whatever it might be, it can add cost, you know, even relative, it's not insignificant relative to what you bought. But, you know, everything that we've done from a M&A standpoint to date really has all been with an eye towards it being strategic acquisition, not a financial acquisition, not a roll up. Mm-hmm. You know, someone could make the arguments to do both of those things, and I necessarily wouldn't even debate them as it being a bad idea, but it isn't what we've been doing. So with that in mind, you know, it's sort of, you know, buy the things, get them integrated, do it the right way at the standard we're doing, and then they should still deliver on their strategic value, even if it costs you a little bit at the beginning.
Makes sense. So over the past 5 years, Expel's revenue has grown, you know, at a pretty incredible compounded annual growth rate of 25%. Do you know how much of that was organic and how much of that came from acquisitions every year on average?
The vast majority has been organic. And even with the revenue we've acquired, you know, a lot of, I mean, maybe the majority of the acquisitions we've done, the businesses have been a customer of ours to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so we're already recognizing, you know, maybe a small part or maybe a more significant portion of their revenue as our revenue already, because we're selling them product. So that has the effect of further, you know, reducing sort of the inorganic component to revenue. But it's been a small portion of that. I think the largest acquisition that we did in 2021, if I'm not mistaken, you know, maybe added $20 million of top line revenue net or something like that. But that was far an outlier. Now, you know, going forward, I think, you know, that could change. There's probably other opportunities for us, but it's been a relatively small part of that historically.
So you don't currently pay a dividend or repurchase shares. And, you know, just personally, I think that's 100% the right strategy because you have ample high return reinvestment opportunities. But can you just briefly tell us how you think about capital allocation and what is your capital allocation philosophy overall?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, which is that we do see ample opportunities to invest, you know, all the cash flow that we generate and then some back into the business in the ways that we described. And we think we can do it at relatively reasonable valuations. And, you know, up to a certain point, that beats any other use for capital from returns at all. Now, I think if you want to criticize us on that in some way, it would probably be that, if that's the case, like, why haven't we been even more aggressive in doing these acquisitions? And I think that's a fair criticism. I think, one, we tend to take a conservative view of things. But two, when you're doing small acquisitions, they tend to be even more predictable or unpredictable rather in terms of the timing it takes to bring them across the finish line. And we probably chronically underestimate how long that takes and how unpredictable that is. So it probably means there needs to be sort of more in the hopper at any one time to overcome that. But if you look at, you know, how we can go wider and how we can go downstream, and you look at the opportunity in the other geographies around the world, you know, I don't have to think too hard that's going to be the best allocation philosophy for us for some time to come.
Yeah, I appreciate you, opening up about what you could potentially be criticized for, and that would be not to grow even faster through acquisitions because they do generate high returns on invested capital for the company. Just personally, I'm not going to ever criticize a company for that because I do think that, well, first of all, just 25% compounded annual growth over 5 years is an incredible number. But I also just personally think that, you know, companies can sometimes try to go too fast, grow too fast. I'm not saying you, but companies have gotten to a point where they try to grow too fast and sometimes the wheels fall off the bike. And so I'm never going to personally criticize a company for, you know, pushing the gas pedal all the way to the floor, even though the reinvestment opportunities do generate such high returns.
Yeah. Well, I think we have a similar view because, you know, the history is littered with the carcasses, poor acquisitions and poor transformative acquisitions and things. And I think, we don't want to be that.
I love that. So I don't know, maybe this is the hardest question of the day. I don't know. You tell me. So not today, but have you and your team considered providing medium-term 3-year financial targets for maybe revenue growth, operating margin, and EPS growth?
Yeah, we've considered it and then probably decided not to do it. Mm-hmm. what's hardest about our business is that our future is made up of the collective results of our thousands of individual customers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of what happens with them sort of follows the trends that we've seen. You know, when things are good, they'll probably kind of move together. If things are not good, they'll probably move together the other way. But they're all very different businesses in terms of their appetite to grow, their appetite to reinvest, their appetite to take on new products or new markets. So it's that that's probably one of the biggest challenges looking at the business is even on a nearer term than a 3-year basis, you know, you're kind of looking backwards to look forwards in terms of what you can expect, because it's not, you know, there's not a simple formula that says, well, if you want to accomplish Y, you know, you need to add this many new XPEL dealers, because they're not all created equal. They're very different businesses. And so, you know, that really doesn't exist. I think, you know, our effort to that end, which I don't think will turn into a, you know, 3-year targets that we publicize, but it's really about looking at, you know, what the business could become as we sort of attack the different segments and look to expand the product and services. And look, that you go through that exercise, it could take you in a lot of different directions.
You won me over. I mean, I think that makes sense. I think that you have thousands of installation partners and dealers that you work with, and they're not all created equally, and they're trying to grow at different rates, and they have different strategies, and so it can be somewhat difficult to, you know, to put 3-year targets out there. So just makes perfect sense to me. Ryan, the 10K says you have a goal of generating the most revenue possible. Personally, I'm okay with that because XPEL generates, you know, as we discussed, returns on invested capital of around 20%. So organic revenue growth is clearly creating a lot of intrinsic value growth. And, you know, when a company generates high returns on invested capital, revenue is the primary driver of intrinsic value. I guess my question is, you know, does XPEL prioritize revenue growth or is it really focused on, you know, balancing revenue growth with profitability, margins, and returns? Is it focused on, you know, a balanced growth strategy?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what we've done, and I think some of the threads in this conversation, you know, it's always to be balanced and to be profitable and good business that we grow, and you know, and the reason is that if you took the other approach, you know, you're limited by the downstream, the downstream, you know, sort of technician level capacity, right? That you can't instantaneously change, even if you accepted radically lower margins or even operating losses, because the same as we've got the thousands of customers that aren't all the same, you know, they have to make their own investing decisions to grow their businesses and hire technicians and do things like that. So it really kind of undercuts, in my mind, a revenue growth at all cost type strategy. So you've really not seen us do that. You know, in terms of our management compensation, you know, short term, we're looking at revenue and EPS out a year, but then longer term on a 3-year basis, we've got revenue growth and ROIC hurdles. And I think if you combine revenue and ROIC, it says, well, you're not going to do revenue at all costs. And it also means you should be disciplined and thoughtful about your M&A strategy. But if the M&A strategy can be done in a disciplined and thoughtful way, well, then that can be a driver of revenue at good returns. So I think we have the pieces there to give everybody the best alignment of incentives. And then it's just a matter of, you know, being able to do it effectively.
I agree. You know, I think your incentive compensation is very well balanced based on revenue, EBITDA, EPS growth. And then as you just said, y'all also consider returns on invested capital over, I think, 3-year period. So incredibly balanced, which is just something I respect a lot about the company and its corporate governance. So risks, 10% of revenue comes from China. Is that a risk or an opportunity?
Oh, well, it's an opportunity. You know, when we talk about the 10% in China, I think sometimes, you know, it's been higher in the past. I think sometimes that's viewed as a customer concentration risk because we have one distributor that represents us that then resells in country. Mm-hmm. But I would view it less as a customer concentration risk because, again, you know, that's being sold to, you know, hundreds or thousands of endpoints of installation in the country. You know, China is probably the most unique market to date for these products in terms of international products, imported products, domestic products. And for us, it is an area of opportunity and a market that we see the ability to grow over time.
So I was going to ask you more broadly outside of Tesla, is OEMs selling directly to customers in the future a long-term risk?
Well, I mean, it's a risk and it's an opportunity. I think that if you want to reach into that 50 or 60% in the middle of the market there that are the non-enthusiasts we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. you're going to need dealerships, you're going to need OEMs, and you're going to need the more broad consumer-facing advertising to reach those people. And what we found today is that if an OEM is selling the product or a dealership is selling the product, they're reaching people that we just don't reach through the aftermarket channel. And similarly, even if a dealership in a local market is offering the product for sale, you know, the enthusiast buyer is very well likely to opt out of that and take their vehicle into the aftermarket where they can get more customized or more bespoke service. So there's risk and opportunity in every side of the business. OEM participation with paint protection film is an opportunity to the extent we win our fair share of it. You know, it's a risk if we don't. But a lot of what is going to be generated through that channel is incremental business. I think what I try to discourage people from thinking about this, the attach rates and the market is small enough, and the enthusiast nature of our core buyer is such a large portion of the business that, you know, there are a lot of other cars out there and there are a lot of other consumers that just don't know about these products. And so it's going to take participation by all of these different groups to chip away at that 50, 60%.
Definitely. Do you have any 10% customers?
Outside of the China distribution, I think that you called out earlier, no.
Awesome. So last risk question, I promise. How big of a long-term risk is technological obsolescence in the sense, what if auto paints are developed so that they have protective film qualities as part of the paint itself?
Yeah, well, I think another way of asking that is sort of like, well, is there a paint to be developed that isn't going to chip, right? A traditional paint that doesn't chip. Historically, that has seemed unlikely, and the more recent trends seem to be more in the opposite direction than that in terms of more environmentally friendly systems seem to have had maybe poorer performance in many cases, increasing the need for protection. But we would call that out as a risk. Obviously, if the paint was impenetrable to damage, that would be a problem for that product. If you used a film instead of paint at scale, you know, that's kind of another version of a paint that doesn't chip, you know, that would be an issue. But there's neither of those seem like something that is, you know, maybe going to happen at all, going to happen anytime soon, or going to happen at an appropriate scale to be disruptive in that way. But I mean, those are certainly the risks that you would call out, you know, or any other alternate product or alternate way to provide the same type of protection to paint that paint protection film does. You know, would be kind of the third leg of that risk.
So, Ryan, XPEL's large and leading market share, I think roughly 35% to 40% in the US, and its consistently high returns on invested capital suggests that the company may have competitive advantages. In your opinion, does XPEL have one or more sustainable competitive advantages? And if so, what do you think they are?
Well, I think we have a bunch of them, but they range from, things that our competitors no doubt are always hard at work trying to match us on, whether it's the film, software patterns, training, marketing. These are all things that everyone would identify as advantages and things for competitors to try and improve on. I think the even harder and sort of less tangible is that we have two other advantages in addition to those, which is, our brand, which has become synonymous with this product and is what the most people think of when they think of the product. And that's a tremendous advantage and one that we want to see continue to grow. And then the other, I think, maybe a little bit harder to understand, but has been our sort of singular focus, where these have been this product set is what everybody here wakes up and is focused on. And that kind of focus and one mission, is a competitive advantage in and of itself, and harder to replicate when you're part of something that's doing a lot of other things as well. So, all of those core things we mentioned, the software, brand, training, film, yeah, we want to continue to build on those and do everything we can to grow our advantage there and defend our position. But then let's play to our strengths too, in terms of the brand and focus, and let's, balance our desire to grow and do other things, because there's no shortage of things we could do, with the need for focus in what we already do. I think that's, from a management standpoint, that's probably one of the hardest things to balance, but we know there's some value there.
So you're highlighting singular focus is the perfect segue into my final question for you. Talk to us about XPEL's culture. What drives you and the other employees to perform every day?
Well, I hope that, the company here is as good for as many of our team as it's been for me. I know it's a motivating factor for me. How do you make it that? I hope it's a place that, people want to work, which means me as the leader, pushing back on things that make it a place people don't want to work. I think we have almost 1,000 employees now. You get to that size from where we started, where I was the 12th employee, and you have all sorts of, lawyers and HR and everything else creeps in. And you have to be careful, because those are things you need to do. We need to run a safe and compliant and fair place. But we also need to be willing to push back and make sure we're doing things intentionally and making it a place that people want to work. I think if you like working here, we have a saying, no tomorrow, which is really just the sense of urgency by which we need to do things and make decisions, resolve issues, whatever it might be. And for the people that like that way of operating, like, I think it's a fun and engaging place to work. And for those that don't like that speed of having to do things, it's probably not, and probably don't last very long. But I think if we can, accomplish kind of those three things and maintain that culture even as we grow, which is probably what worries me more than anything else, is our ability to maintain that, because it's all internally driven rather than externally. But if we can do that, that will be the best competitive advantage we can have over time, I believe.
I agree. And that is the perfect way to end. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing XPEL's story with my listeners. I am very happy to be a share owner, and I wish you and XPEL the best of luck.
Thank you, John. Really enjoyed it. And thanks for having me.
Before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder Anything discussed on the J. Rowe Show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinions and does not constitute formal advice, a recommendation. The J. Rowe Show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.